pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners. We're up to episode 26 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, and we're bringing in a new year, 2016. Scott, a.k.a. the Velvet Glove, how are you feeling?
Never better, Trevor, and a happy new year to you and all our listeners.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So, any New Year's resolutions at all, Scott?
No, I don't make resolutions.
Right, okay. Well, I've resolved to plot the downfall of religion yet again, so...
situation normal, then.
I've got a feeling I'll be making the same resolution next year, having like most resolutions, not fulfilled my initial objective.
Oh dear. So, look, I mean, there's some interesting ones, you know, that do come out at this time of year in particular.
Yes.
Article we didn't talk about was the war on Christmas in the United States.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned that.
Yeah, so we'll tell you what, listeners, we'll grab a news article for next week for that one.
Yeah. So, people like Bill O'Reilly on Fox News and other right-wing hardcore Christians are objecting to some of the more secular sentiments that occur at Christmas and think that there's a war on Christmas.
Meanwhile, it's absurd.
Yes. Meanwhile, all sorts of Christian acts are allowed willy-nilly across society They're so blinkered and self-centred they don't even see them. So, but, you know, the language, a war on... Everything's a war, you know? War on drugs, war on poverty, war on domestic violence, you know, war on Christmas. It's this escalation of language, isn't it? We can't have just a simple disagreement. We have to have a war.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, it's madness, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what we've got, since we had a week or two off, depending on when this gets published, I reckon not a lot's happened in the most recent weeks, but just sort of just after we closed off last time with our Christmas edition. And dear listener, if you didn't like that Christmas edition, then stop listening, because honestly, we can't do much better than that. If that doesn't do it for you, then... sign off and deregister or unsubscribe or whatever, because I really like that one. So if you didn't like that, I don't know what to say.
Dear listener, do keep listening to us, yes.
All right. So what we had since we've last spoken is the ASIO chief, Duncan Lewis, has been... Well, he's been telling coalition MPs urging them to tone down the language that they've used in public discussion on Islam. And what he's said is that some of the public discussion around Islam has the potential to fuel a backlash against Muslims that would make ASIO's work more difficult. And he was defended by Julie Bishop and other members of the coalition for that. What do you think, Velvet Glove?
Look, I think that this was probably a reaction by the anti-Abbott people in the coalition. I think that, Julie Bishop running to defending the ASIO chief Duncan Lewis's calls to coalition MPs, I think that was... I think it was timed in that, because it wasn't all that long ago that Tony Abbott got in trouble for speaking publicly about Islam.
Yep.
And this is, it just smacks of, it just smacks of people wanting to sort of stick the boot into Tony.
Right.
Yeah, that's just a personal opinion. Having said all that, it's a little bit hard to argue with her what she's actually said there. She has defended the right of ASIO chief to ring up and talk to MPs and senators and that sort of stuff and tell them to moderate their language.
Mm.
I find it yeah, it's a little bit hard to, yeah, it's a little bit hard to take it too seriously, to be honest.
I agree with you that it's sort of followed sort of quickly on from Tony Abbott's sort of comments. So
yeah.
I'm sure there's a link there. And I reckon that Mr. Lewis is perfectly entitled to say what he said and to tell the politicians he wants them to tone down their language. But by the same token, I reckon the politicians are perfectly entitled to turn around and say to Mr. Lewis, get stuffed.
Like, exactly.
You just want your job to be easier, but
yeah.
That's not how it works. Like, we don't just get rid of all of our sort of checks and balances in society and our freedom of speech just to make ASIO's job easier and to not offend or insult some sections of the Muslim community. I mean, how condescending. It's like if they criticise the Muslim community, then they're not going to cooperate with ASIO now. Like, what are they, just babies? Like,
well, that's the thing that's really disturbing, is that, you know, you've got this situation that, you know, it's exactly as you said, you know, it's predicated that, you know, oh, well, they're not going to cooperate with ASIO anymore. Well,
yeah.
Grow up, kids.
Yes, I'm sure the moderate Muslims who we all hear about would be saying, well, if I have something of interest to say to ASIO, I'll be saying it, whether or not there's been criticism by some politicians. And if they, you know, if they're not prepared to, then they're not moderate Muslims. Like,
exactly.
How difficult is it to just come forward if you've got something relevant? And so I think, sure, I mean, at least we know where he stands. He's the head of ASIO. He wants his job to be easier. Of course he's going to say stuff like that. And fair enough, say it. But his self-interest is apparent in that. And we can say, well, you know, your self-interest and national security doesn't trump other more important things, such as the need to legitimately criticise Islam and other religions from time to time. And if that happens to make your job more difficult, well, that's the price you pay for a democracy. So,
well, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is the whole point, that if it is more difficult, then, you know, well, you just got to get on with it.
Yeah. So, So that's my take on it. Duncan Lewis, perfectly entitled to say that, and the politicians and anyone else, perfectly entitled to tell him to get stuffed and just work harder.
Exactly. And, thanks to Janelle for pointing this out to us.
Yes, one of our listeners sent us a message on that one, so that's good. Mm. Since we last spoke, there's been discussion about penalty rates and Sunday rates being sort of put into line with Saturday rates at 1.5 times the normal rate. And I just can't believe that there is not more people up in arms about this, Velvet Glove.
It's a surprise to me too. I really would have thought that people would have, you know, chucked a hell of a stink about it. But apparently not. Which is disturbing.
Yep.
Whether or not it means that most of us are now working outside of outside of the retail industry and that sort of stuff. Whether or not we're as a nation, we're not reliant on the penalty rates. I don't know. But it does stick in my throat anyway. You've got a situation that you know, people working for only the same amount as what they did on a Saturday.
Yeah, well, I think it's just showing that the business groups have got more lobbying power and more voice than the poor working class strugglers who don't have all of the think tanks and industry lobby groups, you know, adding to the noise about this. So,
well, that's true, but there's a union group, United Voices, fought to keep Sunday penalty rates. You know, they, where are we? Joanne Schofield said retail and hospitality workers could not afford to take a pay cut. People in retail and hospitality are on modest earnings, so they can't afford to take a pay cut, she said.
Yep.
You know, it's, you know, there was, where was it?
Yeah, for so many workers, it will mean a cut of up to 10% of their income.
Yep, yep. On the people who can least afford it. So
exactly.
So, Scott, if ever, you know, this isn't secular party policy, but my gosh, if ever I got elected, I'd be screaming loud and long about that one, I reckon, to maintain penalty rates, because I would hate... Well, I used to work on Sundays, and when I was young, and you really enjoy proper penalty rates, and you should have them. So if you want to buy... Like, I'm happy to go to a cafe or whatever on a Sunday and pay a surcharge. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. That, you know, I mean, if you had a surcharge that you just knew that you paid and that was it, you move on. You know,
And if you can't make money on that day, close down. And
exactly.
So anyway, that's very not enough support on that. Very surprised on that. Syria. It seems that, I like to mention Syria nearly every week, and once again, in our absence, there was a meeting of the International Syria Support Group that's trying to find a political solution to the conflict, and there are 20 participating countries and organisations who are involved in this, and guess what, Scott?
Australia is the second largest non-American military
player.
Support player. Yeah, that's it. Player is the exact words we should be using.
Yeah.
Was not involved.
Yeah, not invited, not allowed in. So despite the second largest military commitment to the fight against Islamic State, we can't get a seat at a table of 20.
Exactly.
Well, because they say it's a regional thing and they want regional people there, and... Perfectly, well, on one hand, I'm agreeing with them. Yes, that's right. So we shouldn't be fighting. It should be determined by the people in the region, not us. So all the more reason for us just to get the hell out of there. So,
well, I tend to agree now that, you know, I think that we've said we're going to take 12,000 Syrians.
Yes.
As far as I can tell, we've basically said... We're basically done as much as we can expect to be asked to do.
Yes.
So I'm of the opinion that maintaining our airstrikes, our air force over there is no longer worth it.
Yeah, and I reckon most of Australians would agree. I think most people would say, let's get our people out of there and let's keep them for, you know, things that happen in our region. So
agreed,
But that's Syria. Scott, do you believe in miracles?
Well, none that have been attested to by Mother Teresa, no.
Yes. So since we last spoke, Mother Teresa, I'll call her Mother Teresa, but I hear you saying Mother Teresa, but it could be either, I guess. Mother Teresa, the Pope has decided that she will be made a saint in the Roman Catholic Church, and she will likely be canonised in September to coincide with the 19th anniversary of her death. So in the Catholic Church, Velvet Glove, you need two miracles to be attributed to you in order to qualify as a saint. And, of course, a saint is somebody who's deemed to have definitely gone to heaven.
Yes.
And so if you can get one miracle up, then you are beatified. So... Mother Teresa was beatified in 2003 as the Blessed Teresa of Calcutta, and she performed a miracle, apparently, Scott, at that time. Are you aware of her first miracle?
That was the it was non-cancerous, wasn't it? It was a tumour that was in the person's stomach.
It's an Indian woman's tumour is what she cured on that situation. So
there was some argument about that, wasn't it?
Well, I'm reading a bit here. This is an article from Christopher Hitchens, and just going back a bit more on history of Catholic Church and sainthood.
Yeah.
It used to be that you couldn't even be nominated for beatification until 5 years after a person's death, and that was to guard against local or popular enthusiasm for the promotion of dubious characters. And but the Pope nominated Mother Teresa a year after her death in 1997. And and they used to also have what's called a devil's advocate to sort of argue against beatification or sainthood, to provide a contrary voice, but that has also been abolished as well. So there's no longer this devil's advocate voice. But anyway, I'll just read this bit from a Christopher Hitchens article about the first miracle. And he says, surely any respectable Catholic cringes with shame at the obviousness of the fakery. A Bengali woman named Monica Bezra claims that a beam of light emerged from a picture of Mother Teresa, which she happened to have in her home, and relieved her of a cancerous tumour. Her physician, Dr. Ranjan Mustafi, says that she didn't have a cancerous tumour in the first place, and that the tubercular cyst she did have was cured by a course of prescription medicine. Now, was he interviewed by the Vatican investigators? What do you reckon?
Was
the doctor interviewed?
No, he wasn't interviewed.
No, on something as basic as this. So that's right. You know, the Vatican investigators did not even interview Dr. Ranjan Mustafi. And this is a classic, you know, you have these people who, you know known miracle performed during their lifetime. So have this process where if people pray to a certain person and they're miraculously cured, then that qualifies as a miracle performed by the person they were praying to. Goodness sake. So that was her first miracle. And then the second one, I really like this second one. I mean, if you thought the first one was dubious or had, you know, if you thought it was at least a bit funny, I like the second one, which involved the curing of a man in Santos, Brazil, with a serious viral brain infection, according to Father Brian. Oh, Father Brian, I'll call him because his last name's difficult and he just doesn't deserve to have his last name said anyway. he said, the patient's wife continuously sought the intercession of the Blessed Mother Teresa for her husband. The unidentified man was in a coma and about to undergo an emergency operation when a neurosurgeon, returning to the operating room, and found the patient inexplicably awake and without pain, the statement said. The patient made an immediate and full recovery, despite tests showing that prolonged drug treatment had made him sterile. He went on to have two children. Sterile man has two children. I've got a very ordinary explanation for that, Velvet Gloves.
Yeah, that he wasn't sterile in the first place.
Yeah, well, he's not the father of the children. I'm certain, because this guy had chemotherapy. I'm certain that the chemotherapy cured him, and I'm certain it made him sterile. And I'm certain while he was in hospital, his wife's gone and had... you know, if they do a DNA on those two kids, it will be another miracle. You know, a virgin birth of some sort, because this guy's not going to be the father of these kids. So that was the best part of that, I thought, was a sterile man managing to father two children. That's really stretching the envelope of believability.
Well, it is. It really is stretching the envelope of believability.
Yes.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that would be a case for sainthood for a lot of people then, you know, just that alone, if you're, you know, rendered sterile, through some medical procedure, and then your wife gets pregnant. I mean,
yeah.
Start, you know, if we start offering that up as miracle worthy, we're going to have a lot of saints on our hands. Oh, dear.
If we can just, while we're still on this, we can talk about Mother Teresa just a little bit. But Mother Teresa was, during the deliberations of the Second Vatican Council and the stewardship of Pope John, that'd be the 23rd, Mother Teresa was at the fore in opposing all suggestions of reform. What was needed, she maintained, was more work and more faith, not doctrinal revision. I mean, it's absurd that they that this idea that she was a tireless champion of the poor has actually come around.
Yes,
I mean you only have to look, and this will be linked. It's Mummy Dearest. It's reproduced from Christopher Hitchens, and in that he goes quite a lot to talk about the here it is. The Primitive Hospice in Calcutta was run down when she died, as it always had been. She preferred California clinics when she got sick herself, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, she
He makes a compelling case that she was an awful woman who made life miserable, more miserable than it already was, for thousands of people. Yeah. And he says she was not a friend of the poor, she was a friend of poverty. She said that suffering was a gift from God, and she spent her life opposing the only known cure for poverty, which was the empowerment of women. And and birth control. So
exactly.
And you know, she wanted people to suffer in her hospitals because she thought that's what God wanted. And despite having access to potentially far better procedures, she kept them in squalid conditions. And the money she received, where did it go? And these people suffered horrendously in her care. So Mother Teresa was no Mother Teresa.
No, where it went was she opened 500 convents in more than 100 countries, all bearing the name of her own order. You know, and then you can go down further, and, you know, the final line of the article is great. She was a fanatic, a fundamentalist, a fraud, and a church that officially protects those who violate the innocent has given us another clear sign of where it truly stands on moral and ethical questions. You know, it's really quite sickening when you actually read.
It is. It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. It's appalling what she was allowed to get away with.
Yep. And, you know, once again, you know, people say, oh, at least the church gives us moral guidance, etc., etc. Well, this is the sort of crap guidance that we get from the church, an evil woman like this, making people's lives even worse, and she's championed, and they should just cut their losses and go, maybe she didn't do such great stuff after all and just let her fade into history. But no, she's going to be awarded a sainthood. So
yeah, it's absurd.
So there we go. We've often talked about, we haven't talked a lot, maybe a little bit, about tax breaks that religions get in Australia.
That was an interesting article, wasn't it?
And in America, they've been doing some studies of how much the tax exemptions over there are costing the US taxpayer, and they have come up with a figure of $71 billion every year. So I think are we sort of a tenth of the population of America, of the states?
Thereabouts.
Yep. That's sort of, if our economy about the tenth or something like that, you know, if you're a rough guide, $7 billion every year in Australia, if you want to take the same sort of figures. The Secular Party has previously published something that came out and said potentially $30 billion in a year. It's just impossible to know. We don't have any figures. They're not required to report anything, so there's a lot of guesswork involved.
That is exactly it. That, you know, there has been a hell of a lot of guesswork done on that. The Purple Economy was the book by
Max Wallace.
That's him. Yep. That's where the work's come out from, but there'd have to be a hell of a lot of guesswork in that, I would have thought.
Yeah, so I think this report from America is more detailed, and they've come up with that figure, which we can sort of use to some extent in Australia.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money. But they've, you know,
a lot of money.
You know, what they've said here is, for example, the Mormon Church spends roughly 0.7% of its annual income on charity. They found us, their study of 271 congregations found an average of 71% of revenues going to operating expenses. Compare this to the American Red Cross, which uses 92% of revenues for physical assistance and just 7% on operating expenses. So, you know, it's just classic where these religious organisations are using the money for worship and propaganda and getting more members, and they're not really using it for charitable purposes. So one day someone will do a study in Australia, or even before that, one day somebody will change the laws, and that's one of the policies of the Secular Party for sure, is to make religions, you know, if they can prove a charitable purpose, just like other charities, they can keep their tax-exempt status, but they've got to prove it.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the that's the guts of the policy. Yeah.
A little article I've linked to here, Scott. You know, the sort of hate crime statistics out of out of the States. I mean, sorry to sort of have non-Australian stuff, but at least other countries are doing stats and doing studies on things. We can't even get hard figures here, but. You know, we talk about victims of crime due to religious bias. So if you're looking at groups of people who are victims of crime because of the motivation of the person's religion, of the victim's religion, you know, which group would you think were most likely to be the biggest victims? And, you know, in the current climate, I would have expected the sort of Islamic Muslim community to be the biggest group in terms of victims of crime?
You would expect so.
Yeah. Interesting, of this study, of 1,223 victims of hate crime in the US, the biggest group by far was 60.3% was one particular group, and the next biggest was 13.7%. And that 60.3% were Jews.
Is that right?
Because we mentioned at least last time or the time before about Syrians and other refugees who have been indoctrinated with some pretty bad anti-Semitic views coming into Western countries, and I think we talked about Germany and how are they going to handle it. Well, in somewhere like the United States, 60% of hate crimes based on religion are against Jews. So it's a significant thing.
Yeah, and it's that's a really quite a surprising number.
Yeah, it's you know, a big number.
It's a very big number, but very surprising indeed.
Now, Velvet Glove.
My quiz, is it?
No, that's coming up.
Right. Okay.
Well, here's a quiz. here's a quiz for you. Who pays more tax, Qantas or the Iron Fist?
Yeah, the Iron Fist pays more tax than Qantas does.
I do. Isn't that appalling? Just
Look, that's you know, that's based on 2013's numbers, yeah?
Oh, yeah, must have been a bad year for Qantas.
It was a bad year for Qantas in 2013 when they wrote down the carrying value of their A380s.
Yes. Which is losses from the previous year, is it?
Well, no. What that means is that they had they'd bought A380s.
Oh, sorry.
Sitting on the balance sheet.
Okay. So it was writing down equipment, depreciation.
Writing down the value of those. Yes, so it's depreciation.
Yep.
So, yes. In that particular year, Qantas paid no tax.
Yep. And you know what? That's understandable. Now, what we've got here, folks, is a link to major Australian corporations There's 579 that paid no income tax in 2013, 2014. And there are some really, really big companies in there who've paid nothing. And yes, I can understand with someone like Qantas that, you know, they're buying equipment, et cetera, et cetera. That could happen. But, you know, one, there's a lot of companies here. Surely they couldn't all have bought lots of equipment that they're depreciating. Like, for example, I'm looking at one, American Express Australia Limited. So their total income was $943 million.
Yeah.
And they end up paying zero tax.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of companies just like that who, you know, let's face it, I'm sure American Express didn't... I'd be extremely surprised if they, you know, had a large infrastructure purchase that they're writing off. Who knows? They might have with some software, but I'd bet a tidy sum that they didn't. And not, certainly of all these companies that are listed that have earned, you know, enormous sums and paid no tax, here's what's happening, Scott. I guarantee, you know, here's my best guess with American Express, that the local American Express arm had... made all of that, you know, $900 odd million, and within their internal accounting they would have a royalty intellectual property type fee which they would pay to their head office, which conveniently would be enough to wipe out all of their profit in Australia and transfer the profit to their head office, which conveniently I'm sure is based in some low tax country around the world, either Ireland or Singapore or somewhere like that. So what you have is, with a lot of these companies, their international head office bills the Australian company for logos, brand names, intellectual property, nebulous concepts like that to shift the profit out of Australia and into somewhere where they pay less tax.
Exactly.
And it gives me the shits. Like, we can't keep letting these people do this.
Yeah.
We've got to find ways of looking at these agreements and saying, or some sort of deeming provision with these companies to say, If it's too hard to look at these agreements, and I mean, because the accountants are no doubt working overtime to justify these fees and creating all sorts of things in the books to make these fees to the international headquarters look legit and whatever, to talk it all up. I'm sure they spend a lot of accountants spending a lot of time doing that, and we should.
Of course they do.
We need some sort of deeming provision at some point to say, you're going to pay X amount, and we don't care what your international relationships are. And if you don't like it, don't come. Like, if American Express can't pay a dollar of tax in Australia, then we'll just use Visa. Oh, I should scroll down. Visa. I'll go down to V. Maybe they didn't pay tax either. let me see. Virgin. They don't seem to be on my list.
No, not there.
So, you know, that's some sort of deeming provision or something where we and I can accept one-off years companies won't pay tax or whatever, but if this is going on for several years in a row, which I'm sure it is, we could just, that's something the government needs to address. You just can't allow that to happen.
I agree wholeheartedly with you. I mean, it's out of control. It really is madness.
And you know, really, we should just call their bluff and say, if you don't want to do business in here on that basis, then don't come in. Like, we can all survive without American Express.
Yeah.
Off you go. Don't come into Australia. So that would be the iron fist approach.
And look, I tend to agree with you.
Okay.
In all honesty. Like, you know, it's amazing. Like, you look at, Virgin Australia Holdings Limited, you know, $4 billion worth of income.
Yes.
Taxable income, zero.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yes. So there's some big players there, and zero tax. So
yeah.
So have a look at that link if you're interested in which companies are ripping off the Australian society at the moment. Back to miracles, Scott. Now, yeah. You were brought up in the Protestant tradition,
isn't it? I was brought up in the Protestant
tradition. Yeah. So I was brought up a Catholic. And one of the fun things about being a Catholic is that you get to you get to eat the body of Christ.
Yes.
When you go to Mass. So during a Catholic ceremony, the priest has these wafers. And as part of the ceremony, he blesses them, and it is doctrine that the wafer is turned into the actual body of Christ, and if they happen to have some wine there and they do that as well, then that is the blood of Christ. And I used to be an altar boy. Did you know that, Velvet Glove?
No, I didn't know that, no.
So I was an altar boy in my primary school years, and so, you know, people would come up to the altar and stick their tongues out, and the priest would press the wafer on their tongue and they'd swallow it, and we would have a little tray that we would hold under their chin as the priest would do that, and that was to sort of catch any scraps or, you know, little bits that might have fallen off, just because you don't want the body of Christ just falling into the carpet.
No.
In those days, only the priest had wine. I don't know. I haven't been to a Catholic Mass in a long time. I get the feeling that maybe the wine gets passed around a bit more. Well, it's a very... we should go to a Catholic Mass and just see what goes on. I mean, it's a very...
The last one I was at was a nuptial Mass.
Right.
A wedding 4 or 5 years ago. And they had the... Eucharist, which was the isn't that the term you use for the wine?
For the body of Christ is the Eucharist.
No, for the blood of Christ.
No, I think the body is the Eucharist.
Okay. But,
I think. Well, might refer to both. Certainly includes the body.
Yeah, okay. We're not very good Catholics, are we? Anyway, they had the wine in a single cup that they passed around.
Right, so everybody drank from the same cup.
No, most people didn't drink from it.
Right, but if you did want to drink from it, it was from the same cup. See, it's very unhygienic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
That would be why they would avoid that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, so maybe before the next... we have a secular party meeting, folks, in Brisbane on a Sunday... I'm thinking maybe we should head to a Catholic Mass beforehand. This is a bit of an excursion to see what goes on, and then we could hold our meeting afterwards. So
yeah, well, that's always an option, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm. So anyway, where was I heading? So I've got a link to an article where the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City has been investigating a possible miracle. And they had was a consecrated communion wafer. Because the wafers are... How would I describe a wafer is... it's not like a succotar. It's sort of thinner than that. And the really annoying thing about them was that, you know, you'd take one into your mouth and... As you tried to... You weren't supposed to chew it. You're kind of meant to... You weren't meant to really bite down on it, I don't think.
Yeah.
Kind of move it around in your mouth and then swallow it. And they're such a dry, wafery thing that that it would attach to the roof of your mouth and you'd have to work your tongue for a couple of minutes trying to get it off. in Salt Lake City... A wafer began bleeding in water following a mass. So it's... I don't know how the wafer got into the cup of water, but it did, and it was... It had this red stuff coming out of it, and out of a white wafer, and the congregation was thinking that surely this was a sign from Jesus. And, of course... Well, maybe not, of course. It has happened previously in 2011 in Minnesota. and various other places. And would you believe that in the wafer world, there is a fungus or a mold, which is a red colour, and it happens even when you've consecrated the wafer into the very body of Christ, it can still get this mold on it. So relax, folks. It was not a miracle, and it wasn't Jesus bleeding in the glass. It was simply just some red mold, red mold. So there you go. Interestingly, as part of that, I somehow stumbled on a link. I don't think I've told you about this, but somehow I Googled communion wafers.
Somehow you Googled communion wafers.
Yeah, right. And this is an old one. It goes back to 2008, but there was a guy in an atheist academic in America, and the whole communion body of Christ thing was obviously just getting to him. So he invited people to steal the Eucharist and send it to him. And so people would do that, and he would then strike a nail through the wafer and then throw it in the rubbish bin.
Really?
That was part of his thing, and post videos on YouTube about it. And when the church found out about this, well, Father Julian Large of a church in West London said, "We encourage everyone to make personal acts of reparation during the next days for all of the outrages against the Blessed Sacrament around the world. Rosaries, visits to Catholic churches, and any sacrifices we can offer are all suitable." It was to try and make up for the evil deed that Dr. Myers was performing. And so, yes, he called it his Eucharist challenge, in which he incited people to steal hosts so he could destroy them. And he said, "I'm not contrite, I will not repent, and I'm certainly not going to apologise for tossing a cracker in the garbage." He said, "I pierced it with a rusty nail, and I hate Jesus. I hope Jesus' tetanus shots are up to date." using the name Host Hostage, said the cracker was sent to Dr. Myers at the University of Minnesota, and he has treated it with the respect it deserves. So there we go. I don't reckon people would have got away with that in my church. I mean, we watched it go straight in the mouth, and you couldn't have snaffled it into your pocket when I was an altar boy. And I'm critical of the current altar boys if they're allowing that to happen, Scott.
Well, it does make you wonder what they're doing.
What do we got up next? We've got... We're getting close to the quiz.
Hey, you'll be pleased to know I haven't looked at
it. Okay, good. The Andrews government banned religious Christmas carols. Did you know that?
Well, yeah, there was some... There was a bit of a brouhaha about that one, but when you actually looked into it, it turned out to be not as bad as it was made out to be.
Yeah. See, my reading of it was that...
Oh, that's right. This one's paywalled, isn't it?
It might be. It might be.
Yeah.
My reading of it was that they didn't ban all Christmas carols, just those that refer to God. So Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is spared, and I suppose Jingle Bells probably is as well. But anything that referred to God was canned. So I only saw that in one article, and maybe that was wrong, but... It seemed to me that the article was saying that there was a directive issued to the principal of every Victorian public school restricting what carols could be sung, and saying it was the last year that parents would be allowed to volunteer their lunch times to teach kids Christmas carols for the end-of-year concert.
Is that right?
So that was interesting. Do you know, I saw something about this Andrews government. Like, they've been doing great things that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
He's quite religious.
Is he?
Yes. But he takes the view that, you know, church and state should be separated. Very interesting.
Well, that is very interesting.
Yeah. So if I find more about that, I'll talk about it. But it turns out that he's, you know, a committed Christian or something like that. And and despite that, he's passing some of the best secular laws in Australia at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, like, just the adoption laws on homosexuals adopted.
You know, yes.
He has passed laws that restrict the ability of people to argue about the gender of the parents who adopt the kids.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, doing lots of good stuff. Have you seen the new Star Wars movie?
I have, and I've seen it twice.
Really? And it's yes. good?
It's very good, yes. Have you not seen it?
No, I've heard mixed reviews.
Oh, no, it's very good.
Okay. Did you see the biblical connotations?
No, I didn't, but I did find it very amusing when I read in the opening line there, about 500 people attended the special service, more than double the regular congregation size at Berlin Zion Church.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so they normally get sort of 250 people turning up to this church. They had 500 because it was a Star Wars-themed church service.
Yeah, and so they've got, you know, a chance to dress up in your Star Wars outfit and attend a church service. And, you know, the thing that got me... Well, I'm just scrolling through it here. There's a guy called Protestant pastor Lucas Ludwig. And so he's conducted it. And you've got to hand it to some of the religious people, don't they? I mean, you know, dressing things up and making it more interesting to get more people in. Anyway, he said, quote, "Star Wars picks up religious images, including Christian images and maybe some from other religions," said Ludwig. "In doing so, it shows that the Bible and the church are part of our culture that keeps being reworked and reinterpreted." What a load of crap.
Garbage. I mean, there's no biblical bloody...
It's a very thin justification for having a dress up at your church service.
Thin justification. he's really stretching the friendship there.
Yes, I think he has.
Yeah, I mean, there's no biblical references in Star Wars.
It's almost as if he's anticipating, you know, whoever the guy in charge of him is, the local bishop or Monsignor or something, saying, "What the hell are you doing?" And he's going, "Oh, well, it's got religious connotations as a justification." So, you see, I don't know if you've seen on there's been a few sort of Facebook videos with a lot of these sort of evangelical characters in America are going up and down the aisles on their hoverboards. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't
seen those. So, you know, they're kind of in their vestry robes and they're doing their preaching and they're hopping onto hoverboards and going up and down the aisles. And it's kind of spooky to sort of see them moving up and down the aisles on their hoverboards. So you've got to hand it to them. They work their crowd and their audience and throw in a bit of stuff to spice it up.
Well, yeah, I suppose. But, that's really...
Yeah.
It's
odd. Yes. Now, very early on, we had a segment which I called "You Cannot Be Kyrios."
Yes.
And here we go. I'm going to play my little sting for that.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
So one of my resolutions for the new year, Scott, is we have to have more of the "you cannot be curious" moments on our podcast.
Okay.
And, do you want to go ahead with this one that I'm nominating for my "you cannot be curious" moment of the week?
Okay, well, you cannot be curious when you have this statistic. 30% of GOP voters support bombing Agrabah from the city of Aladdin.
Yes.
So 30% of Grand Old Party, the Republican Party, voters support bombing a fictitious city.
It's terrible. You can walk up to people and say, "Do you think we should be bombing Agrabah?" And 30% would say yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really bloody awful, actually. When you really pull it apart and sit down there and think about it, then you've got a real problem.
Yep. Yes.
You know, that's really problematic.
Yeah. Just on that article, there was another thing saying where they asked the Agrabah question to Democrat voters, and they opposed bombing 36-19. While GOP supported it 30-13. I don't know what the others must have been, all don't knows. I don't know. But anyway, The fact that people just don't say, Agrabah, where's that? What's that? Like, sure enough, you may not have seen Aladdin, but you're at least going to go, well, where is it, before you support bombing?
Yeah, exactly. You'd ask, where is it? What have they done?
Mm.
And then you'd turn around and say, okay, yes, that's justifiable to bomb that particular area.
Yes.
You know? It reminds me of a segment that... can't even think of the guy's name. Big Fat Socialist.
Oh, come on, give me more clues than that. Velvet Glove, big, what country?
He's American.
And he's socialist.
Big fat socialist. He's a big fat bloke, and...
he's like a congressman or something.
No, he's not a congressman. He's got a whole heap of shows and that sort of stuff, and he did a weekly thing where they would actually go around and talk to people.
I know the guy who is the movie guy,
Moore.
Yes,
Michael Moore. Yes. Anyway, he had an episode one time where it was called The Painful Truth, and the painful truth was that 40% of people surveyed would support a limited airstrikes against Sweden if the current UN arms embargo failed. You know,
terrible.
It is. It's appalling. You know.
I just hope Australians would fare better in that sort of...
Well, you'd think that you know, they'd say, you know, the question would be, do you support airstrikes against Agrabah?
Mm.
And you'd think to yourself, your first question would be, where is Agrabah?
Mm.
Yeah, it's the capital of where. Mm. What have they done? No, I don't support the airstrikes, or yes, I do, you know. But, you know, but this nonsense of just... going in there and just supporting airstrikes because it seems to be the right thing to do. That's just nonsense. You there? Hello? Yeah, I'm back, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I just talked through and said that, you know, that it was... that it was nonsense and that sort of
stuff. Yeah, fair enough. So Agrabah not safe at the moment from bombing. We'll see what happens in the future. If you're living in Agrabah, start working on a bomb shelter. Now, I came across this thing which really tickled my fancy, and it was I came across because I was watching this speech by a feminist who was talking in a university, and they started talking about safe places and things like that in campuses in America. And we've got this really strange thing happening in American universities, and I worry whether it finds its way here to Australia. But basically, universities used to be places where people could go and provide... you know, alternative theories and ideas and explore and argue. And now in universities, at least at some in America, they're cracking down on that because they're saying that, you know, well, if it's offensive to some members of the university population, then those members need to be protected. And what they're talking about is trigger warnings, that if you're going to talk on a topic, you might, you know, need to issue a trigger warning to people before you start talking, so that they can either leave the room or mentally prepare themselves for the outrageous idea that you might be about to present to them, which might trigger all sorts of horrible thoughts. So I've got a link to an article here, and... Catherine Byron, a senior at Brown University and a member of its Sexual Assault Task Force, considers it her duty to make Brown a safe place for rape victims, free from anything that might prompt memories of trauma. So when she heard last fall that a student group had organised a debate about campus sexual assault between Jessica Valenti, founder of Feminist.com, and Wendy McElroy, a libertarian. See, the problem is that Mrs. McElroy was likely to criticise the term rape culture, and Ms. Byron was alarmed. Bringing in a speaker like that could serve to invalidate people's experience. It could be damaging. So she had a meeting with the administrators of the university, and they decided that they would simultaneously hold a competing talk. And meanwhile, student volunteers put up posters advertising a safe space. And Miss Brown explained that the safe space was intended to give people who might find comments troubling or triggering a place to recuperate. The room. Now, this is the bit I liked. This is the whole reason for telling this bit, Scott. So the line I really liked was, the room was equipped with cookies, colouring books, bubbles, Play-Doh, calming music, pillows, blankets, and a video of frolicking puppies. And as well, students and staff members trained to deal with trauma. Blah, blah, blah. But you know,
you don't want to put people down who have been through rape, because, you know, clearly that's a horrible, disgusting, terrible thing to actually deal
exactly.
with.
Exactly. But.
But, you know, a room with cookies and bubbles and
you know,
videos of frolicking puppies, you know, that's just a little bit over the top.
You know, it's a debate. There'll be somebody giving one view of and I'm sure this person wasn't saying that rape was legitimate and allowed. It was just talking exactly. about, you know, whether the problem is as big as people are making out or blah, blah, like, you know, talking on the edges of it. And, yeah. You know, I worry, Scott, that, you know, if you know, you were to try to organise a debate at a university to discuss Islam, you might get similar sorts of reactions now where debate is actually being, you know, censored because of fear of upsetting people. And at a university, that shouldn't be happening. So there's a thin edge of the wedge occurring in the United States. And look out if you start hearing about safe rooms equipped with cookies, colouring books, and videos of frolicking puppies. Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's just a little bit over the
yeah.
top.
Yeah, so there we go. That's something to look out for. Now, the quiz. We're up to the quiz.
The quiz.
Yes, I've found various sites with different quizzes here. And but I've got a link to a site here that's got an enormous number of quiz-type questions. And
right.
Let me just see some of the better ones here. Okay, Scott, so here's a question for you. What was Jesus... This is hard to say, the possessive word of Jesus. What were Jesus' last words on the cross?
My God, why have you forsaken me?
Ah, very good. And the alternative versions? That's good. Velvet Glove, I'm impressed. You were quoting Matthew 27:46. My God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Luke 23:46 says, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And John 19:30, it is finished. So, very good, Scott. I'm giving you full marks on that one because you got one of the versions perfectly correct. so that's, I'm putting you down. Okay, down for one. Next on the quiz, how long did it take for Jesus to get to heaven after the crucifixion?
Well, he spent 3 days in hell, and then after that returned to earth for 30 days, I think it was, and then after that went to heaven.
Yeah, I haven't heard the hell story, and no, well, You could be right, but that's not in the Bible.
Okay, fair enough.
Matthew 12:40. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Oh, I'm going to give you half marks for that, because that could be a hell. So Matthew says 3 days and three nights, whereas in Luke it says basically the same day. So I'll give you half a point for that. How did Judas die?
Judas hanged himself.
I'll give you a mark for that as well. Bonus points if you know the alternative version.
No, okay. I don't know the alternative version. No.
You're good. I didn't know Judas hanged himself. So you're quoting again. Now, that's Matthew. And is it Matthew earlier that you got right? Yes.
I think it was Matthew.
I think you've been reading a lot of Matthew, Velvet Glove. But how did Judas die? Yes, Matthew 27. Judas hanged himself. But in Acts 1:16-19... Judas bought a field, fell down, and his intestines spilled out.
Really?
So that's the alternative version.
Okay.
Yes. And is Jesus the same as God?
Yes.
I'll give you one for that. That's John 10:30. But similarly, yeah. John says God is greater than Jesus. So that doesn't make sense either. So I'll give you one for that. Look. Okay. That's the quiz for this week. And Velvet Glove, you'll never do better. I'm giving you 3.5 out of 4 on that one, because you've come through with Matthew. Has really he's really worked. You've done well there. Good on you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
That's the quiz. Our military thinks, Scott, that Islamic State, they're on the ropes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's military operations chief says it's now a matter of when, not if, the Islamic State terror group is defeated in Iraq.
Mm.
I mean, it's the rosiest picture yet painted of the often maligned campaign against the militant organisation. David Johnson, the chief's joint operations, said the group was now on the back foot in key fights across the strife-torn country. You know, it's good. I mean, I don't think they're I don't think it's a particularly nice organisation that you want to let live. It's got to be dealt with for sure. I have a major reservation about going into Syria to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Syria, you'd have to, I mean, they're going to have to swallow their pride and talk to Bashar al-Assad and then go in and deal with Islamic State after they've spoken to Bashar al-Assad.
Mm-hmm.
But, it is very good that they're on the back foot and that sort of stuff, but by the same token, he's only talking about Iraq right now.
Mm.
And, ISIS is Iraq and Syria, so... You know, it's. I think one of the main points that you brought up several times before is that we've got to close the border between Turkey and Syria.
Yep.
And and until that's closed, until you've stopped the supply of foreign fighters going in there and that sort of stuff, it is going to have continual problems.
Yep.
Yeah.
We haven't. No country's been successful in a military. Operation yet, and it's just typical for the military to say, yeah, it's all going well, I guess that's their job, they keep saying that, but they've recently retaken Ramadi, I think is the name of the town, which, when you look at it, is so that's been the first sort of major success against Islamic State. But by God, that place was close to Baghdad. And if you couldn't take that back, and it was right on the extremity of a long finger of sort of ISIS-controlled area, and that was hard fought. battle, and there's potentially still some buildings that are still hiding some Islamic State warriors, but, you know, they've got the town back. But, you know, that was should be easy, and that's been tough. So,
Well, I mean, that you know, it makes the point further on, and the many sceptics want to see the recapture of Ramadi and then a clear plan to retake Mosul, Iraq's second biggest
yeah.
city. Well, you know, I mean, if they're going to have to take Mosul back next, I mean, like, that's going to be tougher,
yeah.
I would have thought.
It's going to be a lot tougher. That was easy, the one they've just taken, and it should never have been lost in the first place. It's spitting distance from Baghdad, and the effort involved to get that back. So I wouldn't say ISIS, Islamic State, is lying down, and I take with a grain of salt what our military says about Islamic State being on the ropes. Saudi Arabia has actually been in the news recently, Scott. We didn't put this on the sort of links, but you're no doubt aware that of this problem with the embassy in... Well, Saudi Arabia has executed a Shia scholar/cleric, and Iran is not happy because they're Shia and their man was Shia, and this guy was a... opponent of the Saudi regime and a vocal one, and so as the Saudis want to do, they simply just chopped off his head, and Iraq is up in arms about this now, and furthering tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But back in December 18, Saudi Arabia announced a coalition to challenge Syria, Iran, and the US. So, the... Are you there, Scott?
Yeah,
okay. The Deputy Crown Prince and Minister of Defence of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, announced a new Saudi-led counter-terrorism coalition. And the interesting thing about that, Scott, was it not only surprised the US and adversaries such as Iran and Russia, but it also surprised the members of the coalition because a lot of them weren't aware that they were actually part of it. So Pakistan's foreign secretary said he'd only learned of the initiative when he read the prince's statement and he's asked for clarification. Indonesia was slightly more diplomatic, saying they're observing and waiting to see the modalities of the military coalition, and the Malaysian defence minister ruled out any military commitment. So Saudi Arabia has just said, oh, we formed this coalition, we've got 34 nations who've all agreed to this coalition, and some of them, in fact perhaps all of them, hadn't even heard about it. So
yeah,
it's just a bit of posturing back in December 18,
well, it is,
where they're forming a coalition and trying to get together a bit of power and a bit, because they weren't happy about the Americans striking a sort of a deal with Iran, so they're doing a bit of posturing, and perhaps this latest killing of a Shia cleric is all part of the manoeuvrings between the Sunni-led Sunni sort of group, Saudis, and the Shia Iranians, sort of that division within Islam. We've previously mentioned that I really like this idea that Jesus never existed.
Who was that?
It's just a great idea. Like, nothing is going to get the goat of Christians more than to say, well, you realise, of course, he never existed. And so I've got a link to a new book. I haven't ordered this one yet, but I will. I did a lot of reading on the holidays, Scott. I'm halfway through a book about the Mormons. I had The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran, and a couple of others that I'm working on. And I've got myself a Skeptic's Annotated Bible, so Joe from our secular meetup will be happy with that because he's got one as well. But anyway, so if people are looking for reading, No Meek Messiah is a very scholarly work where this guy lists 126 writers who were contemporaries of Jesus, if he existed, who were talking about all sorts of current events at the time and all sorts of characters, and who made absolutely no mention of the Son of God and his activities around the Sea of Galilee. And
considering what was allegedly happening at the Sea of Galilee at the time, you would have thought that they would have mentioned...
You would have thought that if God's only son, Jesus, who was God himself, but that's an argument for another time, lands on earth and starts healing the sick and performing miracles, that he would be recorded somewhere. And in fact, there are other characters exactly. who are supposedly healing people and stuff, and they were mentioned, but no Jesus. So so no meat Messiah. I reckon I might end up buying a copy of that, and because it goes on to all sorts of other interesting things about Jesus and also wars fought on behalf of religion, etc., etc. So look at that one. But meanwhile, we always like to give the count of you, Scott. Like, you know, it's not all one-way traffic here on the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. So to counter that, I don't know, did I send you this link about the counter view of that one? Did I send that to you? Because this guy's book has come out about the No Meat Messiah, of course, all of the Christian theologians / feriologists are saying, well, that's just totally ridiculous. You know, it's a commonly held view that, of course, Jesus existed. Well, one guy, you know, a bit of an article here, and there's a link to it on the website, and he quotes Oxford professor Richard Swinburne in his book The Resurrection of God Incarnate, who writes that it is 97% probable, based on a Bayes theorem probability analysis of the agreed facts of history, that Jesus Christ really did rise from the dead. Some guy has applied mathematics to the supposedly agreed facts of history and thereby determined a 97% probability that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. There you go. If you're interested, folks, you can look at that and at your leisure. I can't bear to think about it anymore.
Yeah. No, it's bizarre.
And finally, I think, Scott, our last one is, God damn the Catholic Church in Australia. Like, all of the problems where children were molested by their insane priests who are under this vow of celibacy, who...
Yeah.
Like, the cover-ups by the Catholic Church. And there's a link to an article. Back in 1988, there was a bishops' conference, and they were discussing the fact that there's too much paperwork about the and too much talk within the church about these issues, and of course that stuff is able to be accessed by the victims when they subsequently sue the church. So documents and records and letters and correspondence and stuff like that. If you're suing somebody, you are entitled to ask for all relevant papers to be presented. And what there's an exemption to that called legal professional privilege, so that if you are having letters and discussions with your lawyer, then those discussions are not discoverable by the victims. So they came up with a scheme that as soon as a sexual abuse complaint was received by the church, it should forward it to the lawyers, who would then instruct the church to conduct an inquiry. Therefore, all subsequent documentation created from that time would form part of that report and be incorporated as part of that legal professional privilege. So they intentionally basically said, if you get whiff of a problem, immediately tell the lawyers. The lawyers will immediately instruct an inquiry, and therefore anything else that arises from it will be protected and not discoverable by the victims. What a bunch of... And this is, you know, this is the moral guidance we get from the Catholic Church. Velvet Glove?
Yeah, it's bloody disgraceful, isn't it? You know, that they got together and sat down there and said, okay, what do we do to make sure that none of this correspondence can be discoverable? And they cooked it
up. How do we best protect the church and screw the victims? Because it's going to cost us a lot of money. And we continue to give these monsters special privileges. Yeah. God, at some stage, people have to realise all this and say, these are the last people on earth to get special privileges.
Yeah.
So, anyway, there's my little rant, Scott. So, so we're up and away for another year, 2016. And are we getting an election at the end of this year, Scott?
We are due for an election at some point this year. There is some discussion as to whether or not it will be called early. Mm. But I would have thought that they'll probably still do their term, so we'll probably be heading to the polls in August or September. Mm.
So if you're not already a member of the Secular Party, dear listener, please join. We need as many members as possible. Also, we need a few positive reviews on... iTunes. So if you go to our website, ironfistofvelvetglove.com.au, you'll see a little instruction there as to how to do it. So that'd be really nice to leave a positive review. And now, Scott, I've had a few holidays in recent times.
Yes, you have.
And I'm about to go on another one. And I'm concerned that people out there are going to think, what is going on here? But I can assure you, dear listener, I raised four children and I went for a long, long, long time, you know, over a decade, with my only holiday being 2 weeks at Christmas because I had a business and blah, blah, blah. And so I'm just making up for lost time. So next week I will be gone, but I'm sure...
So next week you'll be gone, so it'll be me and Paul next week.
The 12th man will step in, and between the 12th man and the Velvet Glove, they'll rustle up a podcast, and then I'll be back following. So... So you won't hear from me for 2 weeks, but you'll hear from the Velvet Glove next week and the 12th man. So there you go. If you've got any comments or links or things we should know, send us a message. But otherwise, from me, I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yep.
Actually, I won't see you. I'll talk to you.
I'll talk to you all next
week. Exactly. Okay, bye for now.
Bye now. See you then.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, You can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.